We're going to talk today about planning with purpose with money on top of the concept of thirsting for righteousness. And let me begin by saying that all of us in this room have two resources. And that's all, to accomplish what God wants us to accomplish in our lives. And that's time and money. Now, you would probably concur with me that everyone has different amounts of money, but you might say, well, don't we have the same amount of time? We do, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 30 days a month, 365 days a year. But you may remember that someone in the Scriptures talks about our days being numbered. So if you're 55 in this room, raise your hands. No, please don't. You've lived how many days? 20,000 days. If you're 68, you've lived 25,000 days. If you're 82, which no one in this room is even where close to 82, you've lived 30,000 days. So God gives us a different amount of money, and He gives us a different amount of time to accomplish what our purpose in life is. And typically, we face trade-offs in this area. Money and time, oftentimes. To get more of something we want, we almost always have to give up something else. You know the gig? Too much time at the office, oftentimes means too little time at home. Too much focus on spending, oftentimes brings too little focus on savings. So you understand the trade-off that we all have. I think we've got some seats up here as well. And you come back down into the ultimate goal of life, which in my opinion is 2 Timothy 4:7, where Paul says, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race or the course, I have kept the faith. But in my experience of working now 35 years, living life in a balanced, purposeful manner is really, really difficult. At least I know it is for me. Because I go back from one extreme to the other. If you live life well, you will spend your time on what matters most to you, not only now, but as you approach meeting the Lord. If you spend your money on what you, or if you live life well, you will spend your money on what you most value now as well as later. If you live life well, you will live a life of few or no regrets. I remember getting a telephone call 7 or 8 years ago from a lady named Jane. Jane is lives outside of Atlanta, Georgia. She is 6'5". She is a tyrant for God. She teaches a Bible study right now with 50 to 60 to 70 people every Sunday. And she travels extensively because she's got this intellectual curiosity. She loves going to Bible conferences. In fact, I'm actually surprised she's not here. But Jane called me, as I mentioned, 6, 7 years ago and gave me the news that her husband had just died. His name was Bob. And we visited on the experience, and I will never forget, as long as I live, the words that she spoke to me. Because after we had talked about how it happened, what was going on, and she expected it, she said specifically to me, Eric, I have absolutely no regrets. I have absolutely no regrets. Bob and I spent plenty of time with each other. We spent time with our family. We spent our money wisely. And I look forward to seeing him in heaven. Now, how many people can say that? Shame to say, I can't say that. It's just not easy living a purposeful life. It's difficult. It's almost impossible. Why? Before I get into that, let me give you a little bit of context in that we call this our life overview balance sheet. Here's the time issue. So we're born and we all have different amounts of time. Whether it's at work, whether it's at family, church, spending time with God. The second issue of life is basically income, money. So I've got the time issue. I've got the money issue. The time issue from work comes over here where I generate income. And then I spend that income in five places: taxes, giving, living, investing, and debt. We don't have time to discuss that this morning. But this right here and this right here yields the impact that Paul's talking about in 2 Timothy 4:7. I'm going to leave financial capital, I'm going to leave spiritual capital, and I'm going to leave social capital to my children as well as others that I impact. We all understand what financial capital is. It's money, it's wealth, it's stocks, it's real estate. We all understand spiritual capital. It's knowing God intimately. Social capital is the ability to work, the work ethic, the mindset, the ability to honor, gratefulness, gratitude, humility. All of those things we have here, here, and we leave them there. And you should never pass wealth without wisdom. So as you think through the issues of life that we're talking about today, it's really important to understand this impacts it huge, but this does as well, which we'll spend more time on today. Why is it so difficult to live purposefully? Let me give you three reasons that I think why. Number one is noise. Noise. What are you talking about? We got any marketing people in here? Praise Jesus. It's been estimated that each one of us is receiving 3,000 to 6,000 messages each day from marketing people like this lovely lady here telling us what? We're not good enough. We're not pretty enough. We don't have enough. We need more. Isn't that what we're doing? That's what they're teaching us every day. In fact, I love the Will Rogers quote. We spend money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't even like. The Eric Daniels quote on that is, we spend money that we do have to buy things that we already have to impress people that don't care about us. Truth. It's truth. It is truth. I hate to say it, but truth is funny oftentimes. Romans 12:1 says what? To conform your brain, not to the patterns of this world, but by the renewing of your mind. So therefore, the noise that each one of us in this room get and each one of our children get, we're not good enough, we're not pretty enough, we're not successful enough, we don't have enough. 2 Corinthians 10:5 says what? Take every thought captive. Getting that many messages through TV, through internet, through journals, through placards, through billboards. You get the gig. I understand. We're getting 3,000 to 6,000 of those babies every day. And that's why Jesus tells us to take every thought captive. I understand how difficult this is, because I've come to the conclusion we're letting many others, our peer group, some of them very godly men and women, define our happiness. Why do I know that? Because I do. About 10 years ago, a little bit, 10 to 12 years ago, many of our friends and peers were buying lake houses and beach houses. So naturally, what do? We start looking for beach houses and lake houses. But I wanted to one-up them. I wanted to get two. So I got a beach house and I got some beach property in 2004. Now, Jesus is graceful. And the crash hit when? 2007, 2008. I remember telling my wife, honey, we need to sell the beach house. She built the beach house. She furnished the beach house. She looked at me like this. Get away from me, Satan. And for some reason, I wished I could tell you I was brilliant, which I wasn't. God just prompted me to sell. And by God's grace, we sold that house at actually a profit. But I do have some beach land right now that I bought for this, and it's way down here. So I understand. I let others define my happiness. I was talking to a friend of mine that went through the real estate crash of 2008, 2009, a few years ago. He spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on his daughter's wedding. And he looks back with the money that he spent and he says, "Eric, I was an idiot. We could have spent 1/4 of that amount of money and accomplished what my daughter wanted. I did it because I wanted to impress my peers." Takes a lot of humility on that. So noise is the first reason. Second reason is change. We don't like to change, do we? We really don't. That door is often shut and maybe even locked. And especially when it comes to lifestyle or wealth. We get accustomed to our living, don't we? I have a good friend of mine that I know very well that I'm trying to be as innocuous as I possibly can in this regard. He was a real estate developer in the Southeast. And he was meeting with us, and his wife was there, and literally everything had imploded. And anyone in real estate understands what this is like. And as they were together, they were talking about each other, or they were talking about what should we do. And the wife looked at the husband and said, "I need $25,000 for private schooling costs for my boys, our boys." And the husband looked at her and said, "Honey, we don't have it." She says, "I don't care. Go get it." And as we discussed that, the difficulty of adjusting your lifestyle from when it's up here to down here, I'm convinced it's like climbing Mount Everest. It's just very difficult because we don't like to change. I was playing golf with a former Major League Baseball player earlier this year. I'll never forget this conversation. Wonderful young man. He's been basically, I would say he's been retired for 3 or 4 years. I won't tell you who it was or obviously who he played for. Had a very pleasant time. I drove him out to his car in the golf cart. He got the clubs out, and I asked him one question. I said, "John," that's not his name. He's in his mid to late 30s. I said, "What's your plan? What's your plan for the rest of your life?" And he was stunned. He says, "Well, Eric, I've got 3 kids. I've got a big house. I obviously don't need the money. So I think I'll just retire and not do anything." Now, I'm not here to talk about why I don't believe in retirement from a pure sense. We'll talk about that maybe at another time. But I missed an opportunity, because if I play golf with him again, which I may, I am going to tell him, don't let money ruin your life. Because that's what's happening. This young kid is sharper than a tack, has great potential in whatever he wants to do. But he's got this mindset that the world pushes on him, "Well, you don't have to work, then why work?" We won't go into the dignity, etc. Michael Jordan made the same comment to Tiger Woods. "The biggest problem that you're going to have is boredom." What is wrong with these people? You cannot tell me that Satan is not active in this arena. Because common sense goes out the door. Noise, change, and thinking. What do I mean by that? Emerson made the comment, "The key to every man is his thought." Henry Ford said, "Thinking is the hardest work there is to do. That's why so few people engage in it." And Bertrand Russell, the renowned atheist, I love this comment, "Most Christians would rather die than think. In fact, they do." You know, It's not easy to think well. It's not easy to be deliberative, to be reflective, to be intentional about what you're thinking about, to reflect on what we truly value in life. I love this quote by A.W. Tozier. Tozier was quoting a 17th century poet and theologian named Thomas Traherne in this book. Here's what Traherne said in the 17th century. "As nothing is more easy than to think, so nothing is more difficult than to think well." ladies and gentlemen, I can look back on this screwy, I can't use the word, screwy financial decisions, screwy life decisions that I have made. You cannot tell me. I think, but I want to think well. I want to think well. I was speaking at a Vistage conference. Are you familiar with the Vistage conference by any chance? Vistage is a group of men and women that get together. Usually CEOs, 12, 15 of them, will get together every month and they discuss business issues, et cetera, not from a biblical perspective. A number of years ago, I was asked to speak to about 14 of these people on financial and estate planning. And I told them everything I knew in about three and a half hours. And at the end, the moderator did an interesting twist, is he went around to each of the participants and said, what one takeaway from Mr. Daniels are you going to take home with you and apply? Now, I had told them things on financial planning and estate planning. I mean, I was scraping the Milky Way, just brilliant stuff. And I'll bet you 60 to 70% of the men and women in that room said, the idea that Mr. Daniels talked about taking one day a quarter to think, to reflect, to figure out what am I doing right, what am I doing wrong. That was the one takeaway that they came away with. 60 to 70% of them. Satan attacks our minds, right? Why do you think he would not attack our minds when it comes to managing our time or managing our money and being stewards of the people that basically we're supposed to be stewarding? So that's why it's so difficult. You might have some other reasons. Well, let's talk about some keys. Three keys to purpose, to living a life of purpose. How do we use this simple tool of money well? We all have different amounts. How do we spend this money wisely now so that we accomplish what we truly value in life? Not only now, but later. How do we do that? Let me suggest there's three keys to doing this. The first key is to embrace reality. What a simple concept. Jack Welch, in his very first book, made the comment that the number one skill set that he looked for these young people that are not aware of Jack Welch, I forget this all the time. Jack was the CEO and chairman of General Electric. So he was right up here. Still writes in Forbes, doesn't he? Forbes or Fortune, I think he still writes. The number one skill set that Welch looked for in future leader and managers was their ability to deal with reality. The statement he made is face reality straight in the eye and act on it as soon as possible. And it goes for financial planning and managing our resources. How do we embrace reality? Well, let me put a little scare into you. C.S. Lewis said this, there is no neutral ground in the universe. Every square inch, every split second is claimed by God and counterclaimed by Satan. We are in a spiritual battle. And I don't say that lightly. And it's only been recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, because I've been preaching this for 35 years. That's why I'm slow. I'm the oldest of nine. That's what happens. That's why God says 2,000 verses how to deal with money directly and indirectly. 2,000 of them. I'll never forget my mom and my dad. My mom never came to Christ. My dad is an atheist slash agnostic. And I'll never forget when I told my mom I was moving from Indianapolis down to Atlanta to help people understand what the Bible says about money. And she used a pejorative word. That the Bible doesn't talk. They talk about money. 2,000 verses. We need to be in the Word, understanding, because God's teaching us. Because Satan is claiming his ground. Satan wants us thinking the way he thinks. He wants us fearful of the future. Interesting take on that statement is we fear in the direction of our hope. So if our hope is in financial security, what will we fear? we will fear about our financial security, our investments, our spending. If our fear isn't, if our hope is in our position, what will we fear? We will fear about losing that position. If our hope is in our children. I have two grandchildren that just moved to New York within the last week. It's killing us. But you know what? There's a lot of hope in my life that I realize, Lord, you're doing this for a reason. My hope needs to be in you, not my children or my grandchildren. Satan wants us not only be fearful of the future, he wants us to live a life of ease, comfort, and pleasure. I was discipled by a gentleman named Roy Ludwig, who passed away probably 10 years ago. Terry and Paula knew Roy real well. Roy was a brilliant man. His Bible was so full of notes, and he literally would write across the page, down the page, over the page. When he died, his youngest daughter asked, that was the only thing she wanted from her dad. But Roy discipled and mentored me, and he just knew the Word of God so well, and I'll never forget. He says, Eric, we all seek ease, comfort, and pleasure, and God doesn't want any of it. What are we supposed to do serving Christ? To die daily. But yet the world tells us, Satan tells us, that we can live a life of ease, comfort, and pleasure. Satan wants us, the third way, focused on financial independence, not spiritual dependence. He wants us focused on financial independence. I was visiting with a client of mine, actually another ex-Major League Baseball player. I'll never forget this. It was 2009. You guys, let me just put it in context. The market had already gone down about 25%, and it was going down another 25% in January, February of 2009. We had lunch at the OK Cafe, both he and his wife. She and him are there. I'm right here. And he was one of the few clients that I served that looked at me and said, how are you doing, Eric? I almost, whoa, you're thinking about me? I said, well, first of all, you're one of the few people that asked me. And I said to him, said to them, I said, you know, I'm doing okay. I've learned so much. At the same time, I am not kidding you, they lean forward, and both of them at the same time, what have you learned? And I simply said, there is no such thing as financial independence outside God. And they looked back and sat back, and they said, well, but you've been focused on financial independence for us. And I said, yeah, I have. It's my mistake. My bad. And I will change. Because God wants us spiritually dependent upon Him. Financial independence has no bearing at all. In fact, I take the word out anymore. I look at financial freedom. Because you can be financially free with $100 in your wallet, whereas you can't be financially free with $10 million in your pocket. I've seen it. Because we always want more. What about my health, Eric? What about my kids' health? You can dream up crazy ideas no matter how much you gain. Financial freedom is determined today by your relationship with the Lord Jesus. Satan never wants us, I'm more and more convinced of this, Satan never wants us to seek the wisdom of our spouse. Please don't, spouse, either way, don't do this, okay? I'm convinced of that because some of the major mistakes that I've seen made and I've seen myself make is not seeking the wisdom of my spouse. Satan never wants us to seek godly counsel. Ever. And I'll point out a difference. There is a huge difference between wisdom and intelligence. I can buy intelligence. There's plenty of people in this room and around the country that I can buy that intelligence. I can't buy wisdom without spending time with someone, understanding, because that comes from our Lord God, and judgment shows very, very clearly. Satan never wants us to seek accountability. Once again, embrace reality. If you understand the battle that we are in daily, he doesn't want us seeking the wisdom of our spouse. He doesn't want us seeking the wisdom of godly counsel. He doesn't want us having any accountability. Ron Blue was the founder of our firm. He's no longer with the firm. And I asked him to come in and speak to our staff a few weeks ago. And he came in, and I'll never forget it. And we're sitting all around, and Ron is 75 now, and he was talking about what God had taught him over the last 35, 40 years. And he said to our staff, he says, I have a financial planner. I hate him. That financial planner happens to be somebody that I know within our firm. He says, but I know I need him. Because I can get astray with doing it on my own way. I think Scripture has something to say about that. It was so funny, though. I have one, I hate him, but I use him. Ken Boa wrote a book, Conform to His Image, which is one of the finest books on spiritual formation that you will ever read. I would strongly recommend it. It's not something that you read over a weekend. A wonderful book. But in the very beginning of the book, he makes this comment. From the beginning of the Old Testament to the end of the New Testament, the Bible reveals the existence of a vast, highly ordered, and complex spiritual world that exists between God and us. Those who ignore or reject this reality are ill-equipped to deal with the spiritual forces in this world. Wonderful, godly man, and he nailed it. Embrace reality. Listen to what C.S. Lewis said in his book, Screwtape Letters. I'm certain a number of you are familiar with that. For the ones that may not, Screwtape Letters was written from the perspective of Satan. So as you hear this quote that I'm going to share with you, listen to this. The humans live in time, but our enemy, that's God, but our enemy destines them to eternity. Our business, that's what he's talking about right here, our business, Satan and his minions, is to get them away from the eternal and from the present. It is far better to make them live in the future. In a word, the future is of all things the thing least like eternity. Hence, all vices are rooted in the future. Gratitude looks to the past, love looks to the present, fear, avarice, lust, ambition, all look ahead. You couldn't have said any better. That's a novel. Wonderful final quote here. This is not found in the Scriptures, but it is a Jewish proverb. Truth is heavy, so few men carry it. You know, we don't want to know truth. We really don't. I remember during the crash, many people would say, Eric, I don't want to open up my 401k statements because I know that they'll be bad. Truth is heavy, so very few people carry it. That's key one. Key two, we must determine what we truly value. We must determine what we truly value. Dr. Ed Hollowell in his book says, in order to do what really matters to you, you have to, first of all, know what really matters to you. That's deep. Jonathan Edwards said something similar 300 years ago. He says, the ultimate good in life is to treat things according to their true value. Jonathan Edwards may be one of the brightest men that ever walked the face of this earth. The ultimate good in life is to treat things according to their true value. What does that mean? He must have written this, 200-300 years ago. Most of the stuff we treat as true value is not true value. And the ultimate good in life is to recognize that and understand this is what's important. We all run the risk of treating things that don't matter as if they matter, things that do not matter as if they don't matter. We truly have been conditioned, getting back to the marketing messages, we have been conditioned to believe the myth of more. And that happiness is only achieved by what? Having more. I'm living testimony. I'm very, very susceptible to this. Andy Stanley made a comment a number of years ago, raising our standard of living does not equate to raising the quality of our lives. I've almost got that memorized. Raising the standard of your living does not equate to raising the quality of your lives. In fact, in my opinion, in my experience, it's almost the antithesis. You raise that lifestyle, less peace, less freedom occurs. No thing will bring you happiness. Nothing. No thing will bring you happiness. Happiness is about the who, not the what. G.K. Chesterton, one of my favorite authors, wonderful book, Orthodoxy, says there are two ways to get enough. One is to accumulate more and more. The other is to desire less. Isn't that great? That is such a wonderful statement. It's almost as if less stuff is more margin. Less stuff is more wealth. Now, many of you are not familiar with, in this room, but most of you should be, a gentleman named Lee Iacocca. In fact, I'm curious, how many people in here know who Lee Iacocca was? I guess we got a few that don't. And you should. You must be under 30 or whatever it might be. Lee Iacocca was a positive version of Donald Trump 25 years ago. I won't go into politics. I'm staying away from that, all right? But he was the dude. And Rusty, you remember, he was very well respected. He was the CEO and chairman of Chrysler Corporation, took them from being basically bankrupt up. And many people, both political parties, were asking him to run on their ticket. Iacocca wrote this book a number of years after he retired. Listen to this guy's quote. This blows me away because nobody was at the top of the ladder more than Lee Iacocca. As I start the twilight years of my life, I try to think about what it was all about. I'm really still not sure what is meant by good fortune and success. I still can't believe you said this. I know that fame and power is for the birds. And then life suddenly closes in on me and comes into focus. There stand my children, and I love them. No matter what you've done for humanity, if you haven't given love and attention to your own family, what have you really accomplished? What a powerful statement from a guy that was right. Nobody was higher. We need to understand this. I have a friend of mine named Kirby Sevier. Kirby's an attorney, an estate planning attorney in Birmingham, Alabama. I'll try to make this fast, but it's a powerful reflection of really understanding what's important in life. Kirby was working on a mutual client of ours, and we were doing some estate planning for him, and I was to contact Kirby about, okay, here's what we'd like to do, wanted to get your feedback. Obviously, he was going to draft the documents. After we had finished talking about the client, I said, Kirby, how's your golf game? He says, Eric, I don't play golf. I said, you must be a tennis player, because Moulton, who was the client, Moulton plays tennis. No, I don't play tennis. Oh, you're from Alabama. You must hunt and fish. No, I don't hunt and fish. Now, this is a real live conversation on the phone. How would you feel? I mean, it's awkward. I mean, I feel like jumping out through the phone. What do you do, dude? So finally I said to him, in a somewhat of a point of exaggeration, Kirby, what do you do for leisure? I said it as respectful as I could. He says, well, Eric, I have 6 children. So I understood that. But then he began to tell me about something that he started, I believe, in 1992. He says, Eric, well, let me just read it. He began meeting with his first young African-American man in 1992. Eric was his name, and he would drive to the projects, pick him up, attend church, and have lunch. Eric's brother David asked if he could join them, and from there, an additional 6 African-American kids in the projects began on a journey of 10 years, 1992 to 2001. He did that every single week. I asked him 3-4 years ago, how did they all turn out? And he talked about a number of them. He said, this is my synopsis. Eric attended Talladega College, played baseball, got his degree. Then he says something that was interesting. All of them have grown up to be responsible fathers. All marriages have not worked out. But, in fact, I almost get them. all of them are good fathers. That's true value. We've minimized the impact we can have on people. Parents as well as others. If I were to ask you this question, what coach, what teacher made an impact on your life? How many of you would raise your hands and could identify by this name right now? I can. Mrs. Staten, fourth grade. Eric, you're good at math. I remember it. Mr. Aspenlob, he was my coach in basketball my eighth grade year. All of us have those stories. We've minimized. Satan has minimized. Thank you. Gosh, that's too fast. That's all I got is 5 minutes left. Wow. I got to move, boys. Let me tell you. We got started late. They should give me an extra 5 minutes. Okay. I was preaching a number of years ago. Actually, it was many years ago, about 12. And I was going to a church and I was going to preach on success. And I was preparing and my son walked into the room. His name is Ryan. And I got the idea, well, you know, I'll just ask Ryan. How would he define success? I'll use him as an illustration. Ryan? Yeah, Dad. How would you define success? I need more than that, Dad. No. How would you define success? He says, well, it's living in a nice home. Okay. What else? Well, it's driving a nice car. Okay. What else? Well, probably having a lake home. By this time, I'm dying. You know, I poured my life into this kid to teach him about true value and house and cars. So I threw one last line out. What else? Well, Dad probably driving a Porsche. Oh, gosh! I hate to say it. He caught more than he was taught, didn't he? We still have discussions about that. What is your definition of success? What do you truly value? Write it down before you leave this conference. If your spouse is here, get together. Write it down. I have a memorable journal that I literally use, and I take it, and whenever I have a significant event, whether it's playing golf, whether it's being with my kids, whether it's being with my wife, I write it down. I've got my success metric. Write it down. If it's being debt-free, if it's simplicity, if it's margin, if it's relationship with your kids, if it's relationship with your grandkids, if it's the ability to influence others for the kingdom of Christ, this is how we should spend our time. This is how we should spend our money. Don't let the world define success for you. It will steal it from you. The future is purchased by the present. Let me run through a couple of these that are very important. Money is a huge messenger, both in unintentionally as well as intentionally. Every financial action shouts something to one family member and another message to another family member. Finances, whether we like it or not, bleed into every area of our lives. A wonderful book that you need to buy, right here is one of the authors, Family Money. It's an outstanding book. That's right. Looks like this. Please pick that up. If you're not communicating to your children or your grandchildren about money, you're not communicating to them. I came home from Thanksgiving 2 years ago. My dad and my sister, one of my sisters, were there. They think we're these perfect parents. I don't know why, but they do. I go to the store, I come back, and on one side of our kitchen is my youngest daughter, and the other side are my two oldest daughters, and they're yelling at each other. And I walk in, my dad and my sister are there just observing this, and it's going here, and one of them causes one of them a name that I cannot pronounce in public. I did pronounce it last night, so you guys know. Time out. Get in that den. We're ironing this out. 3 hours. 3 hours. No, it felt like four. 3 hours. We discussed this, and what they brought up was the issue of the last one had gotten so much more, and they were jealous. I knew this, but I didn't want to deal with it. The future is purchased by the present. You've got to be intentional. You know in your heart if there's any consternation between those kids or between yourself and your children or between yourself and your grandchildren or whatever it might be. You know in your spirit because God gives us that. I knew that. 3 hours. And it was a wonderful time of tearful discussion. And we still talk about it to this day. Today's financial decisions have a lifetime of implications. They cascade down generations. One of the best moves I ever made was when my middle daughter, my third daughter was, or third child, was 16. And we just weren't jee-hawing. And someone recommended a ranch called J.H. Ranch to me, which is in Southern California, on a father-daughter ranch trip. And I said, I don't have the freaking time to go out there for a week. I can't do this. And God just convicted me. And it changed probably the trajectory of our relationship. She seeks my counsel all the time. But when she was 16, she was going that way and I was going that way. The future is purchased by the present. Well, let me see if I've got... What time is it, ladies and gentlemen? Let me run through this. I'll get three more minutes. Let me run through this as quickly as I can. Some key points. Let me give you three tools very quickly that I think will help you in actually executing how to define success well and how to live purposely. First one is spend time and money on relationships. A better way, I should have changed that title, spend money and time on getting your family involved in others, a mission trip. It's exposing your children to ministries. One of the great compliments I got was from my oldest daughter a number of years ago. She said, Dad, my peer group doesn't have a clue on where to give. They've only seen their parents give to the local church. Nothing wrong with that. But Dad, you exposed us to other ministries, FCCI, Ravi Zacharias International. I brought them to conferences. Get your children involved in serving others, whether it's through mission trips, whether it's through giving. I am more and more convinced giving does break the power of money for us and for our kids. Teach them to give. Teach them to give because giving demonstrates gratefulness. And gratefulness emphasizes what's right in one's life, not what's wrong. Cicero stated it this way, that gratitude is not only the greatest of human virtues, but the parent of all others. Hans Selye, who was a renowned endocrinologist that did a great deal of study on gratitude, he says it is the healthiest of all human emotions and discovered it was the one trait that was most nourishing to one's health. You find me a person that's grateful and I'll find you a wonderful man or woman of God. Real quick story. I was serving a client a number of years ago. He had four children, if I remember correctly. And from an estate tax perspective, we were getting ready to make a sizable gift to each of the family members. They were all married. I think it was $36,000 or $40,000. They make the gift. I come back and I see the client in January of the next year. How'd it go, John? That's not his name. He says, well, it went pretty well. I said, did you get any thank you letters? No, didn't get any thank you letters. Well, did they thank you? Well, they kind of thanked me. I drove away that evening. He lived about 4 hours south of where I live, and I thought to myself, why? And I came up with three reasons. Number one, they could have expected it, but they didn't, because this is the first year that he'd ever done this. Number two, they didn't value it, but I knew all of their financial situation. I was doing planning for all of them. And I knew that 35 or 40 grand was going to be instrumental in helping them financially. But that wasn't it. What do you think the third one was? They deserved it. Is that the antithesis of gratefulness? Absolutely. We should not be raising children. That's the thing that I challenge my children to this day. Please don't think you deserve it. God can take it away like that. Spend money and time on experiences. I won't go into that other than to say experiences create family culture. I love what Mark Batterson, who wrote The Circle Maker out there, and Dick Foth wrote in their book, A Trip Around the Sun. Don't accumulate possessions, accumulate experiences. Possessions are a dime a dozen. Experiences, I love this statement, are the currency of a life well lived. That's an experience that my family took in Costa Rica. I don't have any idea how I got out of there. You see this? You see this? They still talk about that to this day. They capture it, and we have a blast. That's what families do. They create the culture. Finally, let me close. Spend money and time on your posterity. Not prosperity, posterity. For some of you young people, you need to look the word up. It's basically your lineage, your children, your grandchildren. Howard Hendricks is one of my favorite gentlemen. He died 3 or 4 years ago. My fear for you is my greatest fear for myself, and that it is not that you will fail, but that you will succeed in doing the wrong things. Tim Kimmel wrote this comment, and we do it a lot in our family office. This is critical. You can't leave character in a trust account. You can't write your values into a will. You can't bank traits like courage, honesty, and compassion in a safe deposit box. What we need is a plan, a long-term strategy to convey our convictions to the next generation. Dick Davis made the statement, maybe a lesser return on your investments makes sense in exchange for a higher return on life. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to spend money, we need to spend time on what we value. You've got to determine what you really value. There is an art to spending money wisely. With God's grace, everyone in this room, and even me, God will say, well done, good and faithful servant. Thank you very much.